basically focusing on flexible work style. My name is Morgan Webb. I work as Microsoft as a technical evangelist. I focus on client, server, and the management thereof. So I look at the platform and the management side on top of that. In this case, focusing more on the client in the session today. I have the pleasure kind of getting our customers and partners ready for the next wave of products that are coming out from Microsoft. So traditionally, we used to focus on IT Pro. It was kind of very reactive. We used to spend time launching a product and then teaching you about it, which is kind of weird from the adoption cycle, but I think that comes from a legacy way of how we engineered our products. So now we're in a different mode. So we have these technical evangelists around the world, kind of advisors who deal with partners, deal with our customers, deal with partners and customers together, because obviously that's the relationship, that we, the model that we have. But it's really getting you ready for those next wave of products. When they do land, you're aware of them, you're ready to use them. Maybe as a show of hands, can I just have a view of who's actually a partner and a customer? So who's a partner of Microsoft's in the room today? And I'm assuming the rest are all customers. Okay, there's quite a lot of customers actually. That's a very interesting ratio. So it's a key piece, that, because traditionally that's our business model. We work through our partners, and that's how we work with our customers. So this session is going to be on flexible work style. How do we adapt to that? How do we use that? And as I go through the different discussions, I show different components of the technologies. The key takeaways are, firstly, how can I enable my users to have this? How can I enable my users to be flexible with how they use maybe multiple devices, work from different locations? But if I'm a consultant who delivers technology, so I deploy these technologies, how can I guide my customers to move towards a flexible work style? How can I make them realize value in the licensing agreement they've probably bought with Microsoft? So that is kind of where the technical evangelism falls in with Microsoft. We make our customers aware of what they own, make them actually understand what they've bought. And normally MDOP's an interesting line item on the licensing agreement. It's always just there. And then you talk to customers like, oh, I own that? Yes, along with the six products that are inside of it. So we're on quite a big move at the moment internally at Microsoft to make customers aware of what MDOP is, the investment they've made inside of it, the different components that are inside of it, and then skilling up our partners to make them realize the benefits and the value add they can provide to our customers for moving towards this flexible work style. So taking this whole bring your own device, bring your own everything at the moment, how do we take that and actually make it real for our customers? So that advisor piece is an interesting piece, because there's normally a massive disconnect between technical, so IT pro and dev, and business. They don't really understand each other, the languages they speak. So we fill that role. We try and enable our customers so that the technical people at our customers can have the conversation with business and say, we need to roll out this technology because of the benefits. And make business understand the value that it brings to business. Because the biggest gap at the moment worldwide in the IT field is the business is going headstrong and generating revenue. I make widgets and I sell widgets. As IT, we want to use new technology. We want to become dynamic. We want to become proactive. We don't want to keep fighting fires. So that role is very integral at the moment. So we spend a lot of time sharpening the skills of our partners as well as our customers for what they actually own within their products. So that's the area that I kind of play in. So there's quite a lot of content to get through today, but I really enjoy interaction with our partners and customers at events like this. So if you don't get the chance to talk to me now, please grab me in the expo hall tomorrow. Anything around clients, anything around server, anything around management. I have a passion for management. I have a passion for virtualization. So this might just be a piece of it. I really want to encourage you to talk to me, either as a partner with issues with customers, or as a customer, how do I get value out of the products I've actually bought from you? So that's really the kind of passion I have around talking to people around our products. So this one focused on flexible work style. Here's a show of hands. Who actually deals with users bringing in devices, their own devices? Okay, quite a lot. That number's growing. Every event I go to, that number is growing with hands. So my first time presenting in Australia, but many of the other countries that I present in, normally you get a mobile phone contract, comes with a device. I'm not sure if it's the same. Yeah, I've actually looked to see if that's exactly the same policy. Yeah, but all these free devices are coming into the home. And so traditionally the next place is come to the office. Who can guess what the first thing is the user wants when he brings this device into the office? Who said mail? Come down. There's a nice Windows to go, 32 gig stick. Mail. Email. That's the first thing the person wants. Just give me a moment. I just want to see my mail. How's it going? Hey, I'm Morgan. How's it? Mail. I just want to see my mail. What's the next thing off the mail? Oh, all of a sudden, everyone's talking. Eh? Yeah, it's this and this. It's funny how that little incentive works, eh? traditionally, they want to access more and more content. It's that simple. So as Microsoft, we've got this term flexible work style, and I'd like to spend the next 45 minutes or so just showing our view of it, the roadmap we're going down, and what we want to achieve around flexible work style, and how our products will attach to that to make it easier to handle these different scenarios that are coming in. Some of these products are kind of in the infancy, especially user experience virtualization, but some of them have been around for a while, application virtualization. How do we start to marry these? How do we start to use these properly within our tool sets? And it's really interesting to notice that how a lot of our management tool sets plug into all of these. Sometimes people forget about that. The legacy way we produced our products was, yes, your single products, buy them as a single SKU. We're moving away from that. We're moving to a model where everything works together. And the idea is to have a simple management interface, simple management experience, and ideally, at the end of the day, a better user experience as they start to move across multiple devices and multiple locations. So before we get into the kind of overview of MDOP, what is flexible work style? As a term in Microsoft, we look at flexible work style as a user working away from their normal prescribed location, whether it be a desk, whether it be an office, whether it be a hot desk. They move away from that, and they need to be productive. That could be a coffee shop, it could be a restaurant, a customer site. You could be doing a project at a customer site. You're away from the office. How do we allow you to move between these locations and still be productive? And in some cases, more productive, because sometimes being at the office is a bit of a distraction, get less work done. But as a customer, and you have your staff and users coming in, how do we still enable them to do more? Personal circumstances. I have to work at home once a day, once a week, once a month. Something happens at the home, right, my certain users need to work from home. How do we enable them to be more productive? So we term flexible work style the ability to be more productive away from your standard office location. Now, there's three categories to look at around that. Firstly, what is the user's experience? What is the IT pro's experience? He has to provision and manage. And the one piece people forget about, the business. The people who are making money, who want to return on the investment they've made in IT. So as a user, the benefits of flexible work style, I get to be mobile and agile. I get to do the same bit of work, maybe a little bit more, without being in the constraints of my office environment. As IT pro, great, let's enable them. Let's make them productive. Now, what happens to the data? Where does the data sit? What happens to the access coming in through my firewall? Who is actually coming in? Who's moving that data? Who's taking that data? Where is that data going? Those are the things that, as IT pros, we should be concerned about. Yes, we want to enable, but we still want to protect. So we'll look at some of those components now within the couple of tools that we're going to have a look at today. How do we actually provide flexibility but maintain control? And then as the business, so we have our users and our IT pros carrying on. As a business, how do I get value out of the investment I've made? Maybe buying these devices, maybe buying these Windows devices to enable people to become more flexible. But how do I get a return out of IT? And that's one of the biggest problems we have at the moment worldwide, is business looks at IT and goes, you're a cost. You're costing me money to run. I want you to make me dynamic. So we'll look at some of the components. And as I step through the different tools and a couple of the demos, I'm going to keep harping on that little piece. How do we use this to make the business realize the impact and the value of what we're doing? And how do we make the users realize the benefit of what they're getting by what we do? And after both scenarios, how do we look after them? How do we manage them? How do we secure what's actually going on in the environment? So that's going to be the focus areas that we're going to climb into. Application virtualization will be the first piece we have a look at. We'll then have a look at user experience virtualization, understand the roadmap of where Microsoft is going with this. I'll have one slide to guide me through each of the products, but ideally I'd like to climb into a couple of demonstrations with each one and look from the beginning to the end. So how do we actually virtualize the application? What are the things to think about as a user, as a business, as IT pros when we're doing that? When we provision these out, what are the scenarios? If we've made an investment in VDI, how do we couple that with VDI, for example? If we've got non-Windows devices coming in, how do we cater for that? And then looking at UEV, similar principle. What is it, the user experience? How does it work? And then what's happening in the back end? And then we'll have a look at Dart, the recovery toolkit. That, I have a little passion around Dart because I used to do support. I know what it's like to fix devices in remote locations. It's not pretty, especially at horrible times of the day or over the weekend. So we'd like to look at, right, we've set up this beautiful flexibility, all these work styles, people are moving all over the place. What happens when something goes wrong? How do we repair? How do we fix? How do we close that gap of from problem has started to resolution? So ideally, that is kind of the flow I'd like to go through for this session. But I really want you to leave with quite a few aspects. One, technically, but also how do you speak to your customer, or how do you speak to your partners, or how do you speak to the business? Because if you're a customer sitting in the room and you're buying services from a partner, You want them to start leveraging the agreement you've signed. Let them start delivering some of the services. So how do we have that communication? How do we work through that? Okay, so from an overview perspective, a quick 1 minute on MDOP. Who actually uses MDOP? Any of the components in MDOP? Okay, a couple. The numbers are growing. Who's involved in licensing at all? Okay, you get out, all of you. All of you licensing people. Now, I hate licensing. No, I don't like licensing. It's a scary beast. We've made it a little bit simpler, I think, but that little line item for optimization pack, normally very well hidden on the agreement. Someone's got to tell you you've got it before you actually go and have a look. You go, what's this AppV stuff? Oh, you actually own it. Oh, okay. Yeah, you're paying for that. So how do we get the benefit out of that? If you'd like to understand if you or your customers own that, and you're not sure how or the path out of the quickest way to find that out, please come see me after this. I'll give you a very quick avenue to find out if your customers or you own the optimization pack on your licensing agreement. So it's broken into three components: virtualize, management, and the restoration side. It's made up of six products within the side of that pack. It's a dynamic pack. Products move in and out slowly. We have a new one that's come in, UEV. We've had a few move out in the last couple of years, but it's a dynamic pack. Normally, as we purchase products, we incubate them, they normally flow through the optimization pack. It's a software assurance benefit if you invest with a licensing agreement with an enterprise agreement with us. So with inside of that, we have these six components: application virtualization, user experience virtualization, and enterprise desktop virtualization. Those are the three focus areas. Looking at the application layer, looking at the user state above that, but then what's happening with those legacy applications as we move from XP to Windows 7? And that's where MedV kind of climbs in. And that's going to be there for a little while, but as we transition to Windows 8, MedV will start to move out of the optimization pack, because there'll be no use for it as you've moved to 7 and you move 8 and you move forward within your operating systems. And then from a management perspective, remember I spoke to you about that control, those restrictions, what's going on in the back end of my infrastructure? That's where advanced group policy management comes in. That allows us to put a layer of control in that sometimes, actually most times, is missing when it comes to group policy management. Junior administrator goes right click, edit, enable, close. Okay, I'm going home today. What do you mean no one can log in? It's an instant change within group policy. So if you're invested in third party or you don't have a layer to control your group policy management, that is where that comes into play. If that is something that appeals to you, please grab me afterwards. I'll gladly show and tell around the AGPM side. And then MBAM, a kind of our introduction to enterprise desktop management with regards to encryption. How do we know what's going on with our devices that are out there, ones that have been encrypted? How do we provide self-service for users to actually log in and say, well, you know what, I've got a problem, I need to recover, without having to phone first, second line support? What is the one downside with more support calls coming in? Your costs of support go up. If you're a customer, your costs of supporting IT go up. You've got to justify that to business. If you're a partner providing support services to a customer, your customer's users phone in, your support costs go up. So it's a simple model. And at the moment, in IT infrastructure around the IT environment around the world, from a financial perspective, we want to bring those costs down. So that's where MBAM would come in to help with the encryption self-service side of things from the Microsoft suite. And then Dart, which we'll have a look at the end of today, the actual restore process for recovering data, recovering devices, recovering corrupt operating systems, passwords, etc. All right, so that's the flow of what MDOP consists of, and those are the three areas it's focused on. I'm now going to step through a couple of those components. And one thing I will mention, I'm actually not sure if you get the decks after the tech ed. I should have actually asked this question earlier. I think you can download them. If anyone knows, you can say yes now. If not, okay. So there's a reason I talk about that. In this deck, each slide, I've put a lot of content, just to show you. So you'll see a lot of stuff on the board. Don't worry about writing notes down and grabbing it. Take the deck or hit me on Twitter, I will give you the deck. The idea behind this is a lot of content in MDOP. There's a lot of content around the components. So I've put all that content into the PowerPoint itself. It kind of looks like this. So if I jump into AppV, into the notes section, you'll find a lot of content that I've actually added in here for you to use at your own time. So please don't feel, take all the notes down, scribble, write, photos, etc. It's there for you to use, it's there for you to take away. I find the best thing about a session, let's see what's going on and take the content away a bit later and you can review it, use it in your own time from that perspective. So don't feel you have to write everything down and kind of use that. Okay, so AppV, application virtualization. As I step through a couple of the products, I'll build out some pillars. And those are the core kind of structure around what is the product meant to do, maybe where does it come from, what is the idea behind it, and where is it going. So from an application virtualization perspective, there's been a big change from 4x into 5. If you've done sequencing before, you know there was quite a layer that was put in around sequencing to a certain drive letter, certain size around the actual package from the application itself. Limitations. So there weren't limitations 2-3 years ago. There are limitations now on where we're moving in the world with regards to devices. So we've kind of stripped those out. We're now making virtual applications a first-class citizen within the operating system itself. And as we go through some of the sequencing, I'll explain the hows and whys and what to think about when you're doing that. But it really has become a first-class citizen around the operating system. It also adheres to standard Windows operating system file associations, standards. There's no differences around that. And that is our roadmap going forward. There should be no differentiation between a physical application install and a virtual one. It should be treated the same from an operating system perspective. Has anyone, with a show of hands, not seen application virtualization before? Just before I go chapping away. Okay, cool. Flexible virtualization. So how do we enable multiple applications? How do we enable multiple application interaction with each other? How do we enable multiple integrations between physical and virtual within the same platform? The move forward now is it shouldn't matter anymore whether your application's physically installed or virtually installed. The interaction should be seamless from a user perspective. But the change as well in the back end is it should be seamless from a management perspective. You shouldn't have to now start differentiating between physical and virtual and changing your management styles. And ideally, with the release of 5 and going forward, we're trying to make the management as simple as possible with regards to your virtual applications. And we'll have a look at some of that in a few minutes. From a management perspective, we've moved away from the MMC console. We've now moved to browser-based. So you don't have to have this console installed on whatever machine you want to support, do connections, management, et cetera. It's web-based. No matter where you are, head of the browser, straight to the server on the relevant port number, you have your administration tools available for you to work with that. Any PowerShell users in the room? Dabble, like, okay. For those that didn't put their hands up, it's really time to start getting into that layer. You'll notice our products, more and more, that is the base for management. That is the base for the real power of looking after your applications. The same with AppV 5.0 and going forward. You'll see some of the commandlets. I'll bring them up. You can have a look at them and get a view. That is how we manage our products. So every discussion you'll see from Microsoft coming forward in the next, say, couple of years until it becomes the norm is PowerShell. Get used to it. Start getting yourselves well-adverse to it. Okay, so let's just hop across to this different environment quickly. Okay, cool. All right, so for application virtualization, I'll take you through kind of three stages. The first one is the sequencing stage. Sequencing, not so sexy, not the sexiest demo in the world, but there's a couple of things I want to point out in the changes we've made in 5.0 to not only make it simpler, but to make it seamless when it comes to that application to actually operate within its virtual environment. So who has not seen sequencing before? Okay, only a couple. Okay, cool. So I'm not going to spend too much time going through the sequencer. I'll just point out a couple of things along the way and a way of thinking about how you actually do the sequencing with your applications out in the environment. Okay, so creating a virtual application. One thing that has become the norm and is becoming more and more of a practice in third-party applications as well is accelerators to make your life a little bit easier to sequence applications. So the likes of Adobe, the likes of SAP are moving along the way of providing accelerators for you to create your package. Office 2013, 365, it comes out an AppV package. It takes away the complexity we used to have with 4.6 and previous. So moving forward now, we're working on this AppV extension. That is going to be the norm going forward. We're really pushing hard for the package extension of AppV, the way it's done, to be the standard across our products as well as with regards to our partners' products. So if you had the option of using Accelerator, you could pick option 2. I'm going to step through the first wizard just to show you more of the screens in the back end from a process perspective. Now, normally you would get to this point, it would pop up and say to you, you've got a service running that shouldn't be running. Maybe it's Search, maybe it's Defender, those little norms. At this point, you need to have a bit of a process in place of how you sequence your applications. Let's have a vanilla VM, let's work with that, let's turn those services off, let's snapshot it, let's use that as our process going forward. If you do have anything up here that says the machine needs a reboot, maybe you've done a sequence of an application, maybe you've installed an application, and the DLLs haven't been swapped over, and it needs that reboot done, the sequence will pop up and warn you about that. Really simple, either do the reboot, turn the service off, disable it, click refresh, and carry on. The reboot's an interesting one. Used to be a bit of a gotcha in the previous versions. The sequencer now is reboot aware. If you reboot that application post-install, in between the install reboots required, the sequencer will pop up immediately afterwards once you've logged back in again, and it'll carry on the sequencing process. So the reboot aware has made it a lot easier for legacy applications that were a bit sensitive around not rebooting. Because previously, you'd hold back the reboot, it would catch it, and pretend the reboot was done. That was a bit of a nuance with some of the applications that we've seen in the market. So a few small little changes along the way. This piece is a bit of a junction point now. So let me just zoom into that. From an experience perspective, traditionally people like to sequence an application and add in the relevant components and you have your complete package wrapped up. Ideally, we're encouraging more and more customers, more and more technical staff to think about breaking up those applications even at a virtual layer. So allow your middleware, allow your plugins to be separate. What are the benefits? I can sequence one plugin and service multiple applications. And you'll see a change in terminology with a lot of our documentation coming around AppV. It's an application that's a service. You're basically providing a service to your users. So let's sequence that plugin, let's sequence that middleware, and provide that as a service to a variety of applications. Now, standard Microsoft applications, standard third-party applications, normally not very hard to sequence. It's the internal line of business applications where we're seeing a lot of pain around AppV. Applications that are custom written, got custom tying to the hardware, custom tying to the back-end infrastructure, that is where we're seeing most of the pain and sometimes calls into our premier support. Customers going, I'm running down application virtualization, but my internal applications are giving me the following problems. We're really trying to work with our customers to say, think of it just as a service. This does mean one thing though, speaking to developers. That is a problem at the moment. IT prone developers have a traditional blocker amongst them. If you want this to be successful, you need to have a relationship with developers to understand what is going on in the application at the lower layer, so when I do sequence it, I can cater for it, or adjust the code. And that's the tricky one, because normally that's the expensive one. I need to adjust my application to suit what I want to do around the virtualization piece, and that can sometimes be the blocker along the way. But ideally, start to move into the mode of sequencing multiple applications and then connecting them together. Update the application, that's fine, reconnect. Update the plugin, update the middleware, that's fine, reconnect afterwards. So when you start to break these virtual layers apart, it gives you a lot of flexibility as a move down to application virtualization. Okay, really simple standard application. For a couple that haven't seen sequencing before, I'll give you a quick view of what the middleware piece is. Good old maths, that subject I used to spell with, used to struggle with. Small little difference. I now get to select where I want that application to go. Now this piece over here, this last piece, primary virtual application directory, this is where you need to understand with your developers, what is the integration between their line of business application, the operating system, and do they have any components that are integrated into the hardware? Because if you break this application away from the hardware, and they have components inside of that application that are dependent on certain hardware subsystem components, that's going to be a problem. So ideally at this point, we've moved away from that dedicated drive to install applications. We now install natively to the operating system. But if that application still has a tie-in to certain hardware components, you need to be fully aware of what's going on in the background. The easiest way to approach this, and I've seen two examples of this in the US, is literally IT pros have sat down with the developers and gone, this is what sequencing does. This is the end result for the application. The developer stood back and gone, well, our application is not going to work because it does it like this. How do we address it? Opposed to spending months sequencing, fixing, testing, then going to the developer and saying we're having a real problem. So maybe I'm not sure how you sequence at the moment, but that's a nice little takeaway to understand we need to have the integration with developers around how their applications actually function out in your environment or out in your customers' environments at the moment. Okay, so all that's happening now, for the couple that had their hands up, we're taking a point in time look of what's happening in the operating system. Anything forward, we're going to start to capture. We'll make some modifications. We'll then wrap it up at the end from a virtual bubble perspective. Let's give a few seconds to kick in. Anyone ever signed up for that? Come on, show of hands. Who signed up for the CIP? Nice. device, because you all want USB sticks. Yeah, of course I signed up for that. That is very interesting, because that is how we determine in the next version of the product what gets used within the console. So the CIP is to actually work out what do you actually use in the relevant tools. Do you click on this? How often? What do you use? It's how we govern the next version, the next release of the look and feel around the product. I still didn't sign up for it, but that's exactly how it's done, okay? We're not interrogating you. We're not saying, well, how's your licensing done? Where have you been illegal? We're not doing that. It seems to be like a concern as I speak to people around that component. Okay, really simple application, quick install. But the next piece after this is the middleware piece. And this is where we make a decision. Do we leave it together in the same package, or do we separate them apart? In this case, a very simple application with maths, but it needs DirectX as well for the look and feel integration with the graphics. So now, in production, we would look at this and go, right, I'm finished. Let me wrap that application up. Or do I carry on and I add this component in within the application? We're really advising customers, start to break those pieces apart. Yes, we've broken the OS away from the hardware. We've broken applications away from the OS. But we can still break those applications up as well. It makes it easier to service. It makes it easier to maintain going forward. So at this point, you would normally make a junction decision on your applications. Say, right, I'm going to split those up into two virtual bubbles, and I'll connect them later on. Or if need be, I'll wrap them up all together. So from a demo perspective, we'll just finish that like that. Say finish. Okay, second point in time, snap on the machine. What's happened here? What's changed? Take the next stop. And then we make one or two small changes after that. So basically, yeah, for the first use tasks, so let me take what is the first thing a user would do, let me wrap that up into the first few feature blocks, and that'll become the standard what happens. So little things like file open, file save, tools, options, the most commonly thing that would be used. This is where you need to understand from a user's perspective in your environment, what do they actually do around their application usage? How do they use it? What are the common ways? Because there's no point you sequencing as an IT pro and go, well, this is exactly how they use it when they first get it on demand. You need to understand what the user does. It improves the performance on the other side, especially when you move this application into a VDI environment. Then all of a sudden, there's a lot more accessing those resources, using those resources. Any few seconds delay, user frustration, impact, we make a phone call, support calls go up. Again, it's that simple model of user frustration and the issues that can be expected. So let's create those first few feature blocks quickly. Always runs at demo time minutes, opposed to Windows minutes. Okay, so simple things. File new, file open, file save, insert. Now obviously this is gonna vary based on every application that you sequence that you use. But all we've done is the common task, the first use task that a user would do. Great, it's understood now, starts to build those first few feature blocks. But the next piece after the screen is a slight change and modification around how would you use this application and would you use this package. At this point, you'd normally get a view of your internal line of business applications, what's being excluded and why. Your developer needs to see that for a line of business application. We say, look, we're excluding this in the sequencing process. He might turn around and say, no, we actually need that. Right, then we cater for that. Once we finish the sequencing, we make a modification to the virtual registry, the file system, et cetera. But this is the piece, this is the one of the two screens your developers need to have a view of and see of what's going on around the sequencing process. So we can show, in this case, it's really simple. Nothing hectic from application perspective. Now we get a bit of a junction point. Do we want to create this package as it is, wrap it up, it's ready to go? Or do we want to do a little bit more with this application? Maybe we want to use it in a streaming scenario. Maybe we want to use it on certain operating system platforms, certain architectures. We would choose the second option. We'd say customize now, and you'll notice a change in the GUI at the bottom over here. How do we now optimize this application for streaming processes? How do we take those first few feature blocks and we optimize them a little bit more? How do we only make this application run on certain architecture? We have those options. This, again, comes into a bit of a discussion with the developer. Is there any issues with this application running across all platforms, client and server? 32, 64-bit, any interactions that we need to understand or that we need to cater for in the sequencing process. Once again, you'd run that simple run again from this perspective. It takes those first few feature blocks and optimizes them a little bit more. And now we have the decision. Do you have an application that runs on a certain architecture? Right, select the box, the application will be stamped with that, it will not run Despite being separated from the hardware layer and from the OS layer, application will not run on that architecture if that's what it detects on first run. Now we have the option. So maybe we've picked up with the developers that there's a certain file, certain location, certain setting that has been excluded in the sequencing process that we now need to include. You should select the first option at the top. This allows us now to create that package and work within the editor and make the relevant changes that we need to access on the other side. So now you'll see a few more components that have been excluded based on the compression that was done and the optimization that was done for the streaming process. Now developers can get a view again and go, right, we actually need that piece there. Let's make an adjustment. No problem. Say close, give a few seconds, and now I can work within those environments. This is where the developers are interested in. This is where they need to come up with the ideas, the workarounds, the changes, writing differently to the registry, making changes to the file system. Is there anything we need to do with the services that will actually speak to the physical hardware? And this is where the developers get involved. This piece is the second gap with regards to application virtualization. Usually it's the planning piece where IT pros don't speak to developers, but this piece over here. We see a lot of time spent trying to make this application work. When actually speaking to the developer, understanding how the application works, we'll streamline this process to no end, to no extent. Okay, and at this point, we can just go File Save As, and we can save this application. And you'll see a small change in the file format. Just dump it into my document. You'll see we've got a lot less files, a lot less to work with. It now sits in the .app file extension, and that is the package format that we will use for all applications going from 5.0 and forward. Still backward compatible, but going forward, that'll be how we wrap up our virtual applications. Okay, so not rocket science around the sequencing, but there's two takeaways there. Engage with your developers around the application deployment. It'll save you a huge amount of time. We've seen many projects fail because they spend 6 months sequencing applications, fighting their way through, getting to the end and realizing, actually, you know what, this application should have had a change in the code. Should have been changed the way it actually wrote to the OS, to the hardware, what it looked for. Small little changes could have saved a huge amount of cost and time along the way. Okay, from a sequencing perspective, that was the small look and feel, the changes we've made. But from a management perspective, we've made quite a few changes. So we moved away from that legacy Microsoft management console, and we now go purely web-based. And this will be the move forward. Interesting discussion around this one because it's Silverlight-based. Who's ever tried to use Silverlight over a wide area network? It's not friendly. Okay, it's a little bit big. So, but the idea is to stay with web-based. Whether we go the Silverlight route or HTML5 route down the road, different discussion, but at the moment it's Silverlight-based. If you do use this console and you access it over the WAN and you find it's not your server that's struggling, it's this. The management point also brings up a different discussion. Who uses Configuration Manager in the environments or customers' environments? Okay. So you would have noticed a trend, actually quite a lot, great. You would notice a massive trend. We're going down the route of having Configuration Manager as your hierarchy, not just for normal desktop and client management. We're starting to bolt more services on top of Configuration Manager. Why? You have the hierarchy built already, either yourselves or at your customers. Now we want to bolt on. We want to leverage what Configuration Manager can do at the low level and just bolt on the services on top of that. If you do have Configuration Manager environment, there'd be no need to use this console. You would just use the normal snap-in, the normal Microsoft console for Configuration Manager. Slight little difference though. Has anyone noticed that we, in the management console here, we call it connection groups, and in Configuration Manager, we call it virtualized environments. It's like, wow, those are two different things. They're kind of identical. It's almost like our teams just don't talk to each other. So if you do see a bit of a difference, I'm going to speak about connection groups within your consoles back at the office. You'll look at virtualized environments if you're using Service Pack 1 for Configuration Manager. All right, a quick little tour through the console. Really simple. There's two focus areas, packages, connection groups. From a packages perspective, not rocket science behind this, we list the packages and the applications that are within inside of them. If we move like at Office is a good example. So we get the relevant applications that are available to us. There might be certain scenarios where you want to exclude certain applications from the distribution to users of that whole package. Again, maybe internal line of business applications, you might break those up. Certain teams, certain departments, maybe certain countries, you have a framework of a package. But with inside of that, you only want them to have access to certain parts of the application. So there all of a sudden it becomes an option. We sequence everything. And we distribute and we define later on around who gets access to what pieces of the applications within that whole package. Active Directory access hasn't changed, still based on 80 security groups. That'll never change around how we do application packaging from an AppV perspective. Okay, small little few changes. The default configuration. So it's a quick view of, okay, that's right. We have the ability of also importing a package, modifying, making changes, and exporting the configuration of that package and using that again. Slight little benefit if you have multiple applications that you maybe push out countrywide, worldwide, and you make small changes along the way. File type associations, where the desktop shortcut should be, where the shortcut should be, desktop, taskbar, et cetera. So you can have one configuration and make those changes to the configuration and import them differently for different packages. Small little changes, you might not see a lot of use of it if you look after a single environment, but when you get to start to multiple teams, multiple countries, multiple locations, that becomes quite beneficial from a management perspective of the variety of applications that you can have in your environment. Okay, from a publishing perspective, nothing really simple around that. This piece over here, oops, sorry, wrong one. Sorry. That's a bit better. Okay, good old mouse, back to normal one. Okay, so I can step through these now, and I can make the changes that I require based on that, and export the configuration, save it, use it later to re-import on a different package if required. So yes, we've moved the Silverlight route, small changes around this, but centrally, everything should stay within this if you don't have a configuration managed environment. If you do, you stick through this and use this as your management console going forward. The change we've made now on the user side. So from a user's perspective, we've made kind of two real changes that are visible from the beginning. And those changes have gone from 4.x to 5, but as well as from 5 Service Pack 1 to 5 Service Pack 2. So currently within a user's environment, the actual interface to the agent will look like this. In 5 Service Pack 2, we give you the option of actually having this as a virtual package. So if you want to, let's stream the interface to the user. If not, let's just run the basic service. Let it run in the background, let it do what it needs to do. So this package that you see over here, this look and feel, AppV format as well. So a few more little benefits of how stripping those layers apart from the actual physical OS and now from the virtual application as well. So small changes around the look and feel from an application perspective. From a user's perspective, nothing much has changed around the interaction that he has with the application. But from a user management perspective, we do a lot more around PowerShell. So if you find the console a little bit restrictive, if you find you can't achieve as much as you want to through Configuration Manager, PowerShell would be the route to go down to. How does that look, and what are the options that we have within that? So we've included quite a lot there around actual management from a user's perspective. Ideally, first prize, we do it through group policy. We make those changes from a hierarchy perspective. Distribution, management, push out through Configuration Manager. No Configuration Manager, stick with group policy, use AppV Management Server. At the low level, if it's required, we use PowerShell to do the management from a client-to-client perspective to a client basis. So some small changes around being PowerShell aware for the actual application. So simple scenarios, make changes in the sequencing. We're breaking up and allowing the application to become a first-class citizen in the operating system. From a management perspective, we're moving down the route in the long term for Configuration Manager to be that management system. Let's leverage the investment that customers or you as a customer have made around the architecture for Configuration Manager and bolting AppV on top of that and allowing that to go out as a first-class citizen. Other benefits to that, when you start to have devices accessing from outside of the network, you can start to determine from a Configuration Manager perspective in your company portal, right, there's a physical application installed. You're coming from a non-trusted device, here's the virtual application that you can use. One single repository for content to push out to multiple scenarios and multiple devices. From a user perspective, we'd like to take the workings we've done here and move the investment across as well as to VDI. Who works with or deploys VDI at the moment? Okay, so there's been quite a few changes around the look and feel. You look at the new version of Citrix that's coming out in the next little while. application virtualization, number one for them. Let's push that out as the application format. So lots of little benefits from a VDI perspective. Whether it be session-based, whether it be virtual desktop-based, pool or personal, doesn't matter. The ability here is, if you look at all these different scenarios, we have one source of content. That is my virtual package. I stream and I push out now based on that. But it's that investment that you need to do in the beginning to get the applications virtualized and get them out into the environment. Okay, so we've looked at the application layer. Right, we've done OS virtualization, that's been done for a while. Application virtualization, we've done for a while. Now we look one piece on top of that, the user. The user moves around. He moves from Windows device to Windows device. How do we cater for that? And that's kind of where UEV comes into play. Oops, sorry, that's the wrong one. Yep, that's better. So UEV. It is version 1.0. SP1 or 2 is out in beta at the moment that you get access to. So it's a very new component. Who has worked with USMT before? The User State Migration Toolkit. Okay. Toolkit, toolset. They always throw those names around. I always get them wrong. Very simple. We've based the thinking, we've based the workings around how those XML files work to build UEV. Scan the environment, see what's going on, and then apply, depending on how you've configured it. That's all we're doing over here with UEV. What has the user got set up? How has he configured his environment, his application settings, his Windows settings, and let's move them along with him as he goes from Windows device to Windows device, or to virtual desktop to Windows device. So UEV has three key pillars. Personal and flexible experience. I've spoken about flexible work style, I've spoken about different scenarios. If a user moves from device to device, and his experience starts to be very different, and he gets a little bit lost, users look within their blinkers. That is what they see, those XY corners. They don't see outside of that. If they move from device to device and experience a little bit different, possibly pick up the call and just look for some assistance, some support. Nothing wrong with a couple of users, a couple of hundred users. If you're supporting a couple of thousand users, it's a different discussion. So our roadmap here around UEV is a consistent experience as much as possible. Allow the user to configure and make changes to his application settings, his Windows settings, and allow those settings to roam with him. But as IT pros, or as a business, what if we want it to be different? What if we want a standard for certain application, a standard for certain users? So let them have the flexibility, but we govern it at the end of the day. And that's a couple of demos I want to take you through, is how do we allow this flexibility? And at the end of the day, how do we apply some standardization to the user's experience? Out of the box, UEV does come with a couple of settings location templates. And we'll have a look at some of those in the second demo. So we've got some standard templates that you can apply in your environment right now. But if those standard templates don't meet the needs for you, certain users, certain departments, countries, et cetera, we have a generator that will allow you to create your own, modify them, apply them, and push them out. And we'll have a look and see at the third demo how the generator actually gets used and what it does. The idea behind UEV was to actually complement investment customers already made. If you've gone down the route of pushing out Windows 7 or Windows 8 in your environment, let's bolt UEV on top of that. If you've moved to VDI, you've moved to session-based computing, let's leverage the investment you've made in that. If a user uses his desktop at the office, and he goes home and he remotes in, give him the same experience from that environment that he's remoting into. If he uses his iPad, his Galaxy tablet, goes to a customer, restaurant, etc., let him go back into his Windows 7 or Windows 8 environment back in the office, but let that experience be the same for him in the back end as if he was sitting on his Windows PC at the office. So it is version 1, but it is pretty solid for what it does. Because all we've done is we've leveraged the history and the amount of experience that we've learned out of USMT from a process perspective. Okay, so let's have a quick look at UEV. So I'm cognizant of time. Okay, back to my guinea pig client machine. I've got two client machines, client 1 and client 2 in this environment. And I can make some small changes in the environment, log off, log back in again to another device, show you what the experience is. But then I want to show you the workings in the background of what's actually going on and how we manage that from a central location, from a central process perspective. So over here, I'll just bring up a few applications. I've learned along the way that sometimes I actually need to get some advice from the audience on what to pick, because my very first time I demoed this, made some changes, logged off, logged back in again. I changed the default homepage. I went from about blank, which is my default, and I made a google.com, a bit of humor, Google, and logged in the other side, and the guy put his hand in the audience and went, Yeah, but you might have had that as Google before we logged in, before you started the session. So it's very hard to satisfy everyone. So I went, fine, and I changed it to hotchicks.com, went back in again, logged on the other side. He was happy. He was satisfied at that stage that, yes, UEV actually does work. So as an example, someone from the audience, pick one of these options for the calculator. Scientific program, pick one. Scientific. Okay. Let's just leave it there. WordPad. Yeah, kind of hard to satisfy everyone. Personalize, let's change the wallpaper in the background. Red or green, pick a color. Red. Red? Green? Come see me later. Who uses Twitter, by the way? Quite a bit of hot chicks on Twitter in the last few weeks around this whole escort service that we seem to offer at TechEd. That was kind of a shock for me when I arrived. I was like, this is a different TechEd. We get services as well. What a pleasure. Yeah, anyway, that's my sidebar. We're not recording this, are we? I didn't ask that question earlier. I should have asked that. Okay, red. I heard red. Red stands out. Okay, wallpaper changed. Okay, so going to the Windows 8 theme, top left-hand side, your wallpaper changes with you. I'm going to log off, log back into the other machine. It's normally got a second or so delay. You'll watch the wallpaper change in the top left-hand corner from the standard one. You saw me now with a little sunflower or daisy or whatever it is. It'll change, and you'll see the applications will be in the same location. Simple demo, not very sexy, but I just want to show you in the background what's actually happening at the same time. Okay, wallpaper changed. There's a WordPad calculator, and we chose scientific. You guys remember that because I normally forget, and we'll just sign off. So all that's happening in the background, UEV agent is running on this machine. It just polls to have a look. Right, the person's logged off. I need to make a change for whatever applications we're governed by. What settings have been done? That's important as well. It's not just log off. It's also lock. So if a person locks his machine, or on a frequency, it synchronizes. The lock one's interesting. We've seen this rolled out in the financial sector, where people do not log off. They lock. As a teller behind the window, they lock the machine, they go home. Very hard to apply settings to that then, because the person hasn't logged off, he hasn't changed his ticket. So right, so now how do we cater for that? UEV is aware of that. If you lock the machine, the synchronization is done immediately to the central location. Okay, so that was client one. And if I jump down to client two, top left-hand corner, a non-Jeff Woolsey demo. I shouldn't have said that, I should have logged in first and then said that. Okay, small little change, not very sexy. Okay, but wallpapers come across. If I do calc, I don't know the difference. Yes, that is scientific. WordPad. Okay. But the thought is there. Something's changed, moved across, the experience has followed me. What is actually happening in the background? Well, there's two things. One is a central location where we govern where this content is stored, as well as where we place the settings to apply for certain applications. And the other piece is through management, through group policy. What are the changes that we want to apply to our environment going out? So if I minimize that, and I jump back down to my domain controller over here, I have a default policy, and there's three things that apply. One, offline files, yay, they're back. And then Windows components for UEV, two settings locations. Why do we not need offline files? Think of a scenario, a person's working at work, takes his laptop, goes home, makes changes to his application, his settings. Maybe he works within his line of business application, he makes changes. But back in the office, we want standardization around a certain setting. Those settings are recorded through the offline files. Comes back into work, it does a sync immediately with that location. Those settings that you've governed in the central location are applied back to that application. Your settings are reverted back to what you have as a standard in your environment. So offline files is quite important to keep that synchronization for users as they move between devices off the network. And then the two things that I'll show you now, the settings store and the actual settings catalog. The settings store is where the UEV agent stores all the content in a package file, and the settings location is where you would have the catalog where you could store all your actual templates that you'd want to apply to the variety of applications in your environment. So group policy, very simple, we apply the policy out to the devices. Yep. So it'll only do it when he comes back in and he synchronizes back up again. So the change he'll make offline will be a local cache, offline files, comes back in, plugs network cable in, Wi-Fi, it'll do the sync immediately back to that store. Yeah. Is that the answer?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay, so from a group policy perspective, we can define, it's not really rocket science group policy, but there are some in version 1, some templates that we apply as well for our Microsoft products. You can then obviously create more using the generator or create your own ADMX files as well. Within applications, it takes care of IE 8, 9, and 10. Sorry, let me just zoom out a little bit. Office 2007, Office 2010. With the version that's in beta at the moment, we'll cater for the new Microsoft products and the new IE as it releases to become generally available. Got to be careful how you say this releases to manufacturing and generally available. It's become a hot topic on the internet the last few weeks.
The idea is yes.
So, I mean, it's XML. It's all it is. It's extensible. And ideally, vendors should climb onto this. We have noticed an uptake in the US with regards to the research they're doing around the next version of this. So it's not publicly available to actually download third party at the moment, but we do have the likes of Adobe and SAP floating behind us around how to get the benefits out of this. Adobe's a real tricky one because it does a hell of a lot in the background and a hell of a lot in the wrong places, as most traditional applications should be doing, but that's just my view. You got both options. Ideally, we want the vendors to create their own ones because it's standard and we modify. But if you find vendors on moving on boat quick enough, ideally you can start to create your own ones as well. And you'll see that with the generator I'll show you after this. You can create your own one and you can modify that. And I'll show you exactly how that works. Very similar to sequencing that we saw a few minutes ago. Okay, but now where is this being stored? So within my central file server that I have here, I have a folder. Ideally this would be centrally available in your data center. There's two contents, and those is what group policy was configured to set up. Where is the catalog that I might find more settings templates, and where is a store where I can store my content? You put these wherever you want, that's depending on your environment. But the key things are, where do I put my templates? Where do I store the package files? So looking at the catalog, that is where you would store your templates, and I'm going to show you with a generator in a few minutes. Within the store, it starts to break down on your percent, username percent, if that's the simplest variable to use. Within that side of that, you have a hidden folder. And this is where it starts to build up a history of everything you've done with those applications. So we made a change to theme settings, the wallpaper. And the wallpaper is the one interesting one. Because ideally how UEV works, it stores all the changes you've made in that package file. Wallpaper is a little bit different because the wallpaper needs to go as well. So that's one thing to be cognizant of. If a person's downloading 4 meg wallpapers and he changes them every 15 minutes on his cycle, whenever that changes, it's going to synchronize that back up again. Within group policy, one of the settings is don't synchronize the theme. Don't synchronize desktop wallpapers. So you might, as an option, just say, we'll disable that one. Because the user's got the freedom to download his own wallpapers. He loves these 1080p wallpapers. That's going to have an impact. Because remember, when it logs off, when he locks, it has to synchronize that content back up again. I've used the default wallpapers, and they're 420-odd. And that's 100. Oh, so this, the other one's 106. So it's a bit smaller. But just please keep that in the back of your mind. The content has to go somewhere if we're going to synchronize those differences. Okay, a couple of K for the package files. Nothing really large. But ideally now we have the central location. Out of the box, a lot of stuff around Windows, Office, IE, and Windows settings. And those are the two categories, Windows settings and application settings. Windows settings, pretty standard out of the box. But it's the applications that are the third-party vendors, but more importantly, internal line of business applications. How do we allow those settings to move around with our users as well? And that is where the generator comes into play. So if I move back to my little guinea pig machine again, which is not that one, sorry. The IE favorites. I would need to check on that one. Sorry, who asked the question? Can we have a chat afterwards? I actually don't know. I'd have to do a search. I haven't actually looked. That brings up an interesting topic. Who has seen the connection between a Microsoft account and a domain account? Have you seen that in Windows 8? So you can connect the two together. It's very much similar like signing in with your Microsoft account. So your favorites become part of that. The problem is we're seeing a huge trend where IT pros are locking it at a group policy level and saying, you know what, your favorites won't roam with you because you can modify and change. We want to give you your favorites. So that might be an interesting thing. If we roam the favorites and you're blocking at a group policy level, what the impact will be. So I don't know the answer. I'll have to check on that one. With the favorites? Okay, perfect. Great, thank you. Don't come see me, go see him. Hashtag whatever his name is, okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just a quick question. Just around this product, if you were to build it. Obviously, you have a scenario where a person has logged on to many machines potentially. If you were to roll that client out to all those machines, what would it do if you were to manage application settings? Would it merge all together?
So you had the same application on multiple machines?
Yeah, so if you want to manage work.
Okay.
And it's already on 5, 6, 7, you know, that person's logged on to 5, 6, 7 machines.
Yes.
And they've got already have different experiences with Word. What would happen under that situation?
If you haven't rolled the agent out yet, they're going to have that experience where it's configured as.
Yeah.
Only when you get the agent out and does the first synchronization will you start to get your settings becoming the same.
Yeah, I suppose that's what I was asking. Would they just merge together?
It's not going to merge. It's going to apply those settings you've given.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Right.
It's going to say, here's your new settings.
Yep, okay. So it's not doing a gathering.
No. No, okay. Not, it's not true USMT. It's not going to go exactly what's going on.
Right.
It's going to go, yeah, your settings conform.
It's what you specify.
Yeah,
I understand.
100%. And in those scenarios, it'll be a staggered approach. You would actually treat those users who are having multiple devices as probably a little initiative on your own. Let's do them all over one weekend, and we hit all those machines if possible. So when they come in on the Monday morning, it's standard. And we'll deal with the ones a little bit different after that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, quick look at the generator. So this is the generator that comes as part of UEV. And this is now where you would actually do very similar to sequencing, monitor what's going on, make you aware of what the application is doing, and then you can modify and use that as your settings template and store that in the catalog. So as a very simple example, let's create a settings location template. Browse something like Windows Media Player. It's really simple. We'll see a little box pop up on the left-hand side. So all that's doing, very similar to the sequencer, it's monitoring. What is going on? And when I'm finished with my application configuration, stop the monitoring. And let's make those, whatever change in between, you decide what you want to actually include in your template. So right, it's discovering now, we come into the application, and ideally what you would do with your internal line of business applications is you would, again, sit with the developer, it's that hard discussion, but sit with the developer and say, right, let's open the application. Let's see exactly what's going on at the nuts and bolts. And then based on that, decide, do we want to include that in what should roam with the user? Because maybe you've got some components that are writing to System 32 with an application. You might not want that to roam. You might not have the ability for that to be applied in a different location based on permissions. So ideally at that point, do we change the application? Do we exclude it? And that's the hard conversation that normally you would have with the developers. So if I come in here and I make some small changes, let's just go to the tools options, and I click around and I make changes to this application. So I'm just changing the settings. Not that I would ever rip music. Burn. Okay, so all I've done is I've made some changes to the application. On the left-hand side, if you keep an eye view on that, it's going to discover, it's going to see exactly what's gone on, and it's now got a view of exactly what modifications you've made, and now giving you the option of saying, right, I want to create my template based on the changes I've made and how I've set up the application. So if we say next, it gives us a view. Two things, what's happening in the registry, what's happening in the file system. When we say standard and non-standard, we see standard as being acceptable around the ability to roam as a user. So those applications, those configurations are written correctly at the user level. Non-standard is when it starts to write to locations that you wouldn't want to roam, or might be an issue if it does roam from device to device or location to location. So if we look at the registry, it has two standards. This obviously is a very simple demo with Windows Media Player. But if I wanted to include that to roam, it's really simple. It'll build that settings catalog template for me. It'll build that settings template for me that I can actually create and send out. Same for the file system. Come in here and have a look. Ideally, this is where the developer goes, you know what, I do need that. That has to go with the application. Do we leave it like that, or do we rejig the code? Well, that's going to take us 6 months, so we leave it like that for now, and we'll make a change to the application down the line. So only at this point, we'd finish the configuration we'd want, and we'd save that, and we'd create that. And we would save that as the template going forward. It's XML-based, just to go back to the question a bit earlier around applications. So ideally, you run the application, you generate the XML file, and you can push that out into your environment. Okay, that's where the generator would fit in around custom applications. Included in the box applications, if I just step back a few steps here. Oops. If you install UEV and go to Program Files, go to the UEV folder, the Templates folder, and that's where you'll find the standard ones that are included in the box. All those settings you store through Group Policy that correlate to these ones over here. So those out of the box cater up to 2010 and IE10. Going forward, we'll obviously add some more customization options within the templates that you can actually use out of the box. Obviously, you can open these and make some modifications if you want to. If you're into Notepad, you can go the Notepad route as well. Real hardcore. Okay, it's kind of UEV. So we've abstracted the OS, we've abstracted the applications. Our roadmap now is to kind of make the abstraction between the user's state as well. His application settings and his Windows settings. Two things that should roam as much as possible no matter where he logs in and where he goes to. It is a new way of doing things from a Microsoft perspective. So there are going to be some teething problems along the way. The encouragement really is run the application, see what it actually is doing at the low level. If you have the ability to speak to a developer, understand how the application works, then wrap it up. If the application has to be wrapped up at the user level for the state to transfer and move around, again, sit with the developer, understand what the application is doing, wrap it up, and allow that to traverse and move around. Okay. The last piece, and I need to do an honest time check, because I cannot see what the time is on this thing. Okay, so it's an hour, but 15 minutes. A sanity check. This finishes at 3 o'clock. Yes? Sorry, I'm like in 4 o'clock in the morning time at the moment. I'm a bit lost at the moment. Yes, 3 o'clock. Okay. The last piece to have a look at now is, from a support perspective, is the diagnostics and recovery toolset. And I want to show two demonstrations around this. One is just the creation process, but I want to spend a few minutes on that because people seem to think it's only for desktops. I've seen a huge amount of support cases for this being used in back-end server infrastructures and actually fixing problems and addressing problems on the infrastructure layer. So I want to point out a few things and changes we've made in the new version that's coming out now, or is out in beta at the moment. That gap between a person phoning and going, it doesn't work, it's blue screened, they said you've got an update applying, I've now rebooted, it's not coming back, it's in this horrible loop, I've deleted a file. By the time the person logs the call, to the time you respond, to the time you conclude and fix the problem, that's that mean time to repair. The higher that is, the more costs are involved. The lower that is, the savings you make on the other side. Again, it's back to that simple model. If you're a partner, this is a great way of providing services to the users that you support at your customers. Enabling either the users to use this tool, and that's kind of a new way of thinking when you look at Dart, or enabling your first and second line engineers to actually use this on site at a customer. If you're a customer and you look after your own IT department, your own IT infrastructure, your own users, how do I use this to actually give me more time to focus on proactive things? The new way of thinking about the diagnostics and recovery tool set is leaving this in a central location and letting it be accessed by users, then letting IT support climb in when they really are required. Let the user do some repair, let the user do some interaction. In the new version, you now have the ability of using Dart and remoting in and actually doing the work on the other side. And those are a couple of demos that I want to spend in the last few minutes just showing you around support, et cetera, as well as a couple of things that we've picked up along the way from support calls at Microsoft. Let's find my other guinea pig machine. That config manager one. There's two components to Dart. If you've ever downloaded the MDOP tool, you'll notice there's different versions of installers. There's a version of installer for each level of operating system. XP 2003, good old Vista in 2008, 7 R2, 8 2012, and as you go to 8.1 and 2012 R2, there's different installers for that. The one slight change we've made from the previous versions, we don't require you to have a 32-bit machine to create a 32-bit disk. You have an OS, just create the disk. You'll see the difference now in the wizard when I run this tool now. Okay, really simple, the recovery image wizard. What are you creating, 32-bit, 64-bit? The only requirement here is where are the source files? So 64-bit, I've attached the source files to this server. So okay, oops, that was interesting. So there's the source files to Windows 8. Let's double check that. Yeah. Does anyone see something interesting around that? Does it look different? Who said Office? Yeah, I've got the Office icon. Okay, that's interesting. That's a note to myself to feedback. I've got the Windows OS mounted with an Office icon. Okay. I promise you it's Windows. Okay. All right, so all it's going to do now is going to mount and extrapolate the content out of that to build this boot disk. I now have the option of stepping through all the tools. I'm going to show you the tools now when I boot off this disk. I won't step through them line by line now. But here is where you build in the functionality for what you want to arm your users or arm your support staff with. Level one and level two, maybe you don't want to give them certain tools. The interesting one over here is the locksmith. That is for resetting local account passwords. It doesn't ask you what was the old password, what do you want the new one to be? It goes, what do you want the new one to be? Done. Reboot. Very powerful to have that. You might not want that tool in first and second line or user's hands. So maybe we untick that box and we don't use that. So we can choose whatever we want, add, move, etc. Do we want to allow remote connectivity? So this is a new component within Dart, allowing a user to boot off this ISO, WIM file, and actually allow us to remote connect in and make the changes we need. Yes, we can allow it. Please call. And you can put your call center number in when you see the sign, for example. Now, this piece becomes very important if you're repairing servers. Because the first thing that you require once you boot off Dart is to talk to the network card and to talk to your hard disks. In servers, normally it's a RAID controller. So ideally, when you create this disk, you want to fix a certain type of server, you'd include the drivers in here to speak to the RAID controller, because then I can actually access the storage, and I can actually do work with it. WinPE, we have now a few additional options within that to run a bit of a few PowerShell commandlets within that support environment. So if required, you can add some more and do some more customization within that. Crash Analyzer, using the debugging tools, machines blue screening. I want to see exactly what argument is failing within the OS when this actually starts up. Great, let me analyze that dump file and see exactly what's going on. And then Defender. This option here is not so regularly used because if you've got an issue that's got with a machine with malware on it, you want to create a brand new disk, have the latest definitions on it, repair it. So normally this one gets left out with a general disk that you would send around your environment. Because obviously if you create a disk, you put it in a central location, users can access to use it, you have a machine that you want to interrogate and actually clean up, those definitions are going to be old, obviously, since when you've created to where you want to fix. So just think of Defender as maybe one of the ones you uncheck, and you only use the Defender one when you want to fix and treat a server or a client OS immediately. And that's it. That's the wizard. We then have the options of creating a few options around WIM files, ISO, or PowerShell. Maybe you want to use PowerShell and you repeat this process. You have PowerShell available to you as well. WIM file, I can put that out through Config Manager. I can put that out any ESD, or I can put it in a central location and allow people to boot or pixie boot off of it. The only issue with this is if you allow people from a remote location to boot off a central location and use an ISO file or use a WIM file, is a user on the other side doing the work. So if you wanted to, you could actually edit the image afterwards over here and make some changes within the actual structure. And with a little small answer file, say, yes, I want network connectivity. Yes, this is the configuration. Yes, allow remote connections. So as soon as the person boots off of it, you have total connectivity through to actually do the work. No need to speak to the user on the other side. And I'll give you an example of that as I boot this machine off now. And that's it. Create. It'll actually go away and build that disk for us, and the file will be there for the output for us to use. What is the experience like? I'll find my second guinea pig machine. I've got one of those ISO files attached. We'll just start this machine up quickly. First question that's going to come up is, do you want network connectivity? Now, ideally, in the answer file, you would set that standard. So there's no chance the user going, no, I don't know what that is, no. Okay, let me call the desk now. Can you remote? No, I can't remote. And then you spend half an hour trying to ping, see what's going on. You hide the screen. So yes, we want network connectivity. So yes to that. We'll do English today. I'm supposed to bow Albanian. Has anyone not used this new look and feel around Windows 8, this new recovery console? So I'm saying not used. Okay, quite a few. Okay, so I'll spend 1 minute on that quickly. So this is the normal look and feel as you move through. It's not just because of Dart. If you go and do recovery in Windows 8, this is the look and feel you'll go through. The top three icons, refresh, reset, and advanced, are standard with the OS. Dart is the one we've added on now with the wizard that I've just done. Refresh and reset, very similar words, very different meanings. If you ever do a refresh, it leaves your data intact and it'll refresh your OS, refresh your applications. You do a reset, we're starting brand new. So if you go and do a refresh or a user does a refresh and he goes, I'm sitting on 4% and it's been like 2 hours. He's picked the wrong option. His data's gone. Okay. It's very different two scenarios, very closely worded. Yeah, I'll do a reset. It zeroes out your hard drive, starts again. The one downside around this is that you can actually do this for the console as well. If you go into control panel, you can do a refresh and a reset. Hide that in group policy, lock that. There's nothing worse than a person going, yeah. It asks you three times, are you sure you want to reset? Are you sure you want to reset? Are you really sure you want to reset? By that stage, if you've clicked yes three times, you know what's going to happen. Okay, so ideally lock that through group policy. People don't have access to that. Advanced options, you can use something called rec image, R-E-C-I-M-A-G-E, rec image. Create your own recovery image, and that can be the one that you can use as your system image recovery. You can include that on your base OS going out in your environment or mount it in a central location. It's your custom built environment. If you buy a device from an OEM and you go recovery image, it's their pre-built one that'll be sitting there. So if you don't redo an OS, I would encourage you to change the recovery image at least so that it's your corporate image that sits there. Okay, so those are the standards. The difference is this one that I'm going to go through now. I have a quick look at the tools that are available to us. Registry editor, really simple, regedit. Maybe you've made a change, maybe a user's made a change. Change a 0 to a 1, not the end of the world, reboot. Doesn't come back. That's a small difference, a 0 and a 1, I've learned. You can come in here and make the change, reboot the machine again. Very different to being in this reboot cycle and rebuilding the machine and going, okay, it works now. I come back in here, I boot off this disk, I change that 1 back to a 0, we reboot, we're back to normal again. Very powerful, the registry editor. Again, you might not want to include that in the first line, second line, or user's hands. Uncheck the box, it's not available. Like the crash analyzer. Sorry, I shouldn't have zoomed out there. The crash analyzer is blacked out because we've unchecked the box. Not available for me to use. Locksmith, I've explained the locksmith already. File store. If a user phones you, I've deleted a file, tell them don't do anything, don't touch. Don't go and copy it from your friend next door who had a USB copy from last night and copy it on and realize the wrong version. If you put a file name with the same structure onto that location, it puts it back into the same sectors in the hard drive. Then you've lost the data. If a person hasn't done that yet, this will allow you to recover the data, almost like a bit of undelete in the background. Disk commander, recovering partitions, maybe doing a check disk on any healthy partitions in your environment, unhealthy. Disk wipe, we do 0, and we do 4 passes. Those are your choices. 4 passes, that's the Department of Defense standard. It's quite a lot of passes. That data's gone. So if you're at a customer or you are a customer who likes to reprovision old machines to charities, schools, home use programs, sell it back to employees, it might be worthwhile sending it through one of these just once at least if you are concerned about data or you're concerned about compliancy. Computer management, normal computer management. Event viewer, shares, users, groups, etc. Help is just as help. We're not rocket science behind that. Explorer, browsing local hard drive. Solution Wizard, along with help, probably the two least used components within Dart. It tells you what it thinks is wrong, and it'll help you along the way. And TCP/IP configuration. If the person's clicked yes, I want network connectivity, and you don't have DHCP or can't get an IP address, you can click on here. You can obviously just configure local IP settings. Hotfix uninstall, the second most used component out of Dart. We've rolled out some patches. There could be a machine, for whatever reason, not healthy, doesn't come back. Click that wizard, it scans and looks for all the KB uninstall files, folders that are there, and uninstalls the relevant one you want from a simple checkbox. Reboot the machine. Traditional way of fixing corrupt machine, I rebuild the OS. This is a lot simpler, a lot easier. System file checker, if I need to make any changes within the file system itself, I can do that. The other search defender, very self-explanatory, but remote connection, that is a nice new component. So now over here, I've given the user the option. You see this help desk message, call me, phone this number. Then on the other side, I can bring up the actual remote connection viewer as part of Dart. So if I go back to my call manager box, call manager, Cisco background, configuration manager, I have my viewer. I now need a ticket number. Okay, sorry, this is going to just suck for 1 second. A box will pop up and it'll give me actually a ticket number that I can use, the IP address, and the actual connection. All you want from the user is the ticket number and the IP address, nothing else. So I can use that here. And basically, I'm on that machine now on the other side. So simple remote connectivity. But I'm remote connecting into RAM. Remember this OS running in Windows PE, the hard disk's offline, the hard disk's malleable. I can fix, I can repair, I can make changes, I can troubleshoot, all within this console now. So now all of a sudden I can really go the remote connectivity to the nth degree in repairing this machine. I can run the tools I want, reboot. User, phone me back when you see that message again. So the only one nuance to this now in this version is that ticket number piece. That is automatically generated by the tool. So if you wanted to integrate this into your ticket logging system, help desk, et cetera, you would need to have one small piece of orchestration in the background to take that ticket number and generate a help desk call on the other side. And then we're away in the normal process. So the remote connection, nice new feature within Dart, allowing us to have the ultimate degree in the ability to do some remote support. Okay, so at this point now, we've kind of looked at three scenarios. So we've looked at AppV, we looked at UEV, and we looked at Dart. Three interesting components. If you own MDOP, I would encourage you to at least start playing with some of these. If you support customers, I would encourage you to look at Dart. That is going to bring down a huge amount of support calls, as well as travel and remote support connectivity requirements. Very three little interesting pieces around that. If you want more information around the other components, please come have a chat to me after the session. There's some more information I do have around this I'd love to share. But the one last piece I would like to mention with regards to, maybe I won't be showing it. Okay, number one's gone on the blinker. Okay, we'll leave it for a few seconds, so I don't know what's wrong with the switch won't go across. The one thing I'd really like to stress is the evaluations that you guys fill in for our sessions. Sometimes evaluations are seen like a bit of a, yeah, I'll just tick the boxes. It'll be interesting for you to understand what we do with those evaluations, that content. The only way we structure the content for all our sessions around the world is based on those eval forms. It's the only piece that you fill in when you attend our sessions. Too many demos, too little demos. Coffee wrong flavor, less sugar. Little things like that are very important to us. I would please encourage you that once you finish the session, please fill out that eval form and give us some real world feedback of interaction with the sessions, interaction with TechEd on a whole. I don't know if you've been to other sessions, you've probably seen the last two slides around the giveaways and what's next. I'll see if we get it fixed in a few minutes. But ideally, please, thank you very much for coming. Please fill out the evaluation forms. If you want more information around MDOP, some of the stuff we've looked at today, please hit me up on Twitter or come and see me and take my email address. My role is to interact with customers and partners. It's not a sales, Microsoft sales role. Please come and have a chat to us, and thank you very much for coming today. I hope you enjoy the rest of TechEd. Thank you.